Good morning. I'm going to call to order the meeting of the House Early Childhood Finance and Policy Division. We'll start by having the clerk take the roll.
Representative Pinto, Chair.
Present.
Representative Katiza-Watoon, Vice Chair.
Present.
Representative Franson. Representative Bonner. Representative Damuth.
Present.
Representative Heintzman.
I'm here.
Representative Morrison. Representative Pryor. Representative Wasilik?
Present.
Representative West?
Thank you. So I think we're one short of a quorum. So when somebody comes in, we'll get the minutes approved, maybe at the break. Members, we're continuing this morning with some presentations that kind of lay the groundwork for us in understanding early childhood issues. Last week, we heard about brain development and prenatal care and birth, et cetera. And now we're going to be hearing today from an economist at the Carlson School, here from Professor Sojourner, and also from Children's Defense Fund, to just understand kind of the landscape of early childhood issues in our state, and in particular the need for and economics of child care and getting a good start to life. So, Professor Sojourner, Dr. Sojourner, do you have a preference?
You can call me Aaron, it's fine. Or
that's fine. Yeah. I may not do that, but that's okay.
Professor Sojourner.
So we'll begin with your presentation, and then we'll get the minutes approved at the end of that. And then one other question. Would you prefer to have questions during the presentation or afterwards? That's fine, during?
Please, yeah.
Okay, good. All right, yeah. So if folks have questions, please indicate that. We'll go from there. So, Professor, please start.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. Thank you all for sharing some time with me and inviting me to talk with you about this really important issue.
And if we can get a microphone right in front of you, unless I can't tell if there is one, but I think it's on either side. Oh, you're okay there. Okay.
Thank you for having me. Thanks for sharing your time with me. I'm going to talk to you about, you guys can see these slides. The first 1,000 days. So that's the first 3 years, and how that's important for community success. You know, start with a couple of premises. First, you know, people are really the foundation of community success. If the people in the community aren't flourishing, the economy, families, nothing else can flourish. And if we can create, use wise investment in people to drive the success of our communities. So that's sort of the foundational assumptions here. I'm a labor economist. I really think that is people, skills, and capacities are essential to the economy and society. So getting the right foundation is really critical. I wanted to just show you some evidence from the economics literature and the human development literature. So this first graph is from a paper in Child Development. On the horizontal across the bottom there, you see the average annual family income during the kid's first 5 years. And then on the vertical, you see, you know, years later when they're adults, the average number of hours that they're working each year. And what you can see is that kids who grow up in families with low income, are less likely to be attached to the labor force, less likely to be making contributions to the economy. And this isn't just pure correlation. This is like looking across siblings within the same families, who are born at different times in the family's development. Family has different income at different periods. So this is comparing siblings. This is not differences across families. This is differences within families. This is a graph from a Council of Economic Advisors report. There's a lot of different versions of this, but the key thing to notice is that, you know, we see these big gaps in adult productivity between kids who grew up in low-income versus higher-income families. We also see these gaps. They don't show up in K-12 or in college, late adolescence. They show up very early in life. So this graph shows you the kid's age across the horizontal for age 1, age 2, up to age 14. And it shows you the blue line is the average standardized test scores, achievement levels for kids whose parents are in the highest fifth of income in the country. So, you know, they start off very young, you know, about average, close to zero is average in the country. And then they just make steady improvements. And the bottom orange line is the same thing, average achievement for kids whose parents are in the bottom fifth of income. And so, you know, by the time they're age five, this gap has really opened up. And it doesn't really widen. Once they're into the K-12 system, it kind of is stabilized. So in a sense, maybe the K-12 system is doing work stopping the separation. But something's happening early in kids' lives that creates this wedge. And this is like test scores. I think you heard from Dr. Megan Gunner maybe last week or 2 weeks ago, who talked to you, I'm sure, about brain development. And, you know, labor economists spent about 80 years trying to understand adult labor market productivity by looking at adult predictors, you know, what industry you're in, what occupation you have. But we started to realize, like, people really do develop through a process, you know, from birth or prenatally, you know, into adulthood. And you can't understand how people are going to do as adults in life unless you understand that process of development that they went through. And you can't go back and recover lost time. And so this graph shows a very similar pattern. It shows kids' age in months on the bottom. So you see, you know, from 5 months up to basically 3 years. And it shows the brain architecture, a measure of brain development, total gray matter in the brain, for kids from high socioeconomic status, medium and low socioeconomic status families. And what you can see is that in the first year of life, they're kind of the same, but then this gap opens up, okay? And so whether you look at test scores or you look at brain architecture, these income-based gaps open up early and they show up later in life in terms of work and other things. The question
is, Dr. Gunner, can I just can you go back a slide? So I just want to sort of highlight or just call, have you just talk a little bit more. I feel like because this number of months is a pretty small number. Like even at 18 months, there's quite a big gap in brain size. Can you just talk about kind of how early that shows up? Because I think for many of us that'd be pretty that's pretty surprising.
Yeah. So you know, going back to here, you can see from birth in the very early years, there's very little gap between the kids from higher income families, blue line with the high families coming from families with the top 20% of income versus the orange line. Bottom 20% of income. And you can see, like, by five, it's really there. It's showing up, you know, there's some gap early on, and the tests are hard to, you know, they're not as so great early on. But you definitely see this pattern of they start off similar, and they this gap emerges, and then later on it kind of stabilizes. And if you look at the brain architecture, you see the same thing. You see that even from the very beginning, when they're the earliest ages, when they can do brain scans, age 5 months, there's very little gap between kids, depending on their family's income or you know parents' socioeconomic status. And even in the first year, there's not much separation. 11 months, 12 months, it's starting to open up there. But then in the next 2 years, between ages one and age the kid's third birthday, so over those 2 years, you see this gap opening up. And I think the big question a lot of people have is like, well, look, people are different. They come from different families, different backgrounds. You know, how much of this is baked in the cake or how much of this is subject to, you know, different experiences that people have? And what I'm going to suggest to you is that there's a lot of evidence that better early experiences can break this relationship between family income and child development. And I'm going to tell you about a study that I worked on. It's one of many studies in the literature. It's just one that I worked on and I know well. And I think it's a valuable piece of evidence. And this is an experiment. I mean, so this is very clean evidence where They recruited about 1,000 families in hospitals giving birth to children, and they recruited them into the study, and they randomly assigned a third of them to a treatment and two-thirds of them to the control. This was in 8 cities in 8 different cities around the country in the mid-'80s. It's called the Infant Health and Development Program. It's sort of inspired by and built on the Abbasidarian study that was done in North Carolina. In the first year of life, they got weekly home visits. They were offered weekly home visits. If they were randomly assigned to the treatment group, they were offered weekly home visits. And then from age 12 months to 36 months, so for 2 years, the child was eligible to go to a child development center that the researchers set up in each of these 8 cities and staffed and opened up to these families who were, just won the coin flip. It was free, full day, high quality, free transportation. And, it's kind of a, it was selected, it includes not just low-income families, it also included high-income families. It's one of the few studies that we have that has real clean random assignment for not just low income but also high income. And this is what happened in terms of kids' development. So at age 1, at age 12 months, the flat line there at 0, it just tells you the average IQ score, cognitive skill score for low income kids in the control group. And then the blue dot shows you the average IQ score for low income kids in the treatment group. And after a year of home visiting at age 12 months, there's a little bit of a gap. It wasn't significant. But after a year and 2 years of access to this free, full-day, high-quality care, the kids in the treatment group who are just like the kids in the control group, this is coin flip, nothing different about them, except heads came up instead of tails, and they were offered access to this child development center. Their IQ scores are more than a standard deviation and a half above the control group, okay? So the low-income kids in the treatment group who had access to this, and they didn't all take it up, they were given the choice to have access, and some of them did and some of them didn't. Some chose more, some chose less. But they're outperforming the high-income control group. So their IQs scores at this point, after a year or two, are higher than the high-income control group. So they look just like the kids from higher-income families. So the question is, at 36 months, on the kid's third birthday, the centers closed down, the kids were sent back into the community, there was no further investment after the kid's third birthday. And so, they did follow up, though, 2 years later at kindergarten entry, 5 years later, third grade, 15 years later, near high school graduation. And, there were still, the effects faded down, but not out. And there were still very big positive persistent effects on kids' cognitive skill, even much later. If you look just at the high-income group, you can see the control group average, again, is the 0. And they had positive effects. These are pretty big effects, really, in the first couple years there. But then they fade out and they go away. So, this access to the high-quality care for kids from higher-income families, it had some temporary positive effect, but it wasn't persistent. And so you really do see this story of differential effects that, these investments make a much bigger and more persistent difference for kids from more disadvantaged families than other families. Now, you guys, I'm sure, are familiar with Art Rolnick's work and Rob Grunewald estimating very high rates of return from some of the early demonstration projects. Other people have done similar work. This is a study from James Heckman, is a Nobel laureate at University of Chicago. He estimated an 8% return on some early childhood investment programs, conservatively, that's the lower bound here. And I just want to compare that to, the rate of return to private capital in the stock market, which averages about 5.8%, say 6% since World War II. And I want to tell you that 8% is much more than double 6%. when it comes to rate of return, okay? It sounds like a small difference, but it's a really big difference because of the way that compound growth works. So 8% doesn't sound like much, but if you invest a dollar for 50 years at 6%, you end up with about $20. If you invest it at 8%, you end up with $50. So, you know, these small differences aren't small over the time scales that we're talking about. And, you know, just this is a very stylized graph, but the basic point is that human capacities develop through a lifelong process. And early on in kids' life, their brains are very subject to contingency based on the experiences they're having. If they're having high-quality experiences, it sets the foundation right, and that they live with that, and we all live with that for the many decades to come. And if the foundation sets wrong, you can fix it later, you can make some progress, but, you know, it gets baked in more fully, and it gets more expensive to change. And that's just the way that biology and architecture of brains and human development works. So that's my first point. Income-based gaps open up early, and income-based gaps are subject to change. They're not inevitable. Different experiences can change those developmental trajectories. The second point I want to make is that current policy is kind of perverse in that we ask the most of families when they have the least. And this is true for every family. I mean, this is the way that we structure things makes the early years of families' lives very, very hard and makes it easier later on. So this is based on a report that I did when I worked at the White House Council of Economic Advisors. I was there from the summer of 2016 to the summer of 17. So I was there half in the Obama administration, half in the Trump administration. And, you know, I got to work with great people in both administrations, and including Ivanka's team, and, you know, helped them with a lot of the analysis they were doing to try to lift up child care and parental leave policy as well. And they were very interested in this work as well, and showed a lot of leadership. We did this brief right around the time of the transition, and it brought forward some new evidence that hadn't been discussed before. The basic argument that we make here is that families have the least private resources early in their lives. So when their kids are young, they have the least private resources. And they also have the most private responsibility early. And the combination of those two creates just a cascade of crises that are entirely predictable and show up in a lot of different ways and have a lot of different faces. They all go back to that fundamental tension, I think. So one way to think about it is that when your kids are young, you're young. You've had less years to work and save, so you have less past income, right? You also have less current earning power. So if you can see here, we looked at parents' wages, parents' hours worked, as a function of the age of the youngest child in their family. So if your youngest child is age 0 to 2, your hourly wage is about 8% lower than it is over the course of the kids' lives. This makes sense. You're younger, you have less experience, you have less education. When your kids are older, when they're getting on towards college, you know, you're earning a lot more. You can earn a lot more, and you can work a lot more. So you have less current earning power when your kids are youngest. And we documented this for the first time, which is that your credit scores are lower. So you might hope that younger families might have better access to future income because they have more future income ahead of them than they do when, you know, their kids are getting close to college. But in fact, their credit scores are lower. So look, that means they have less past income, less current income, and less access to future income than they do later when their kids are in K-12 or in college. So, like, that's all the income, guys. That's there's no other income for families besides past, present, and future income. So that puts families with young children in a really severe budget crisis, right? It's very expensive to meet the care responsibility. If a parent wants to forego work in the labor market and parent their children and spend their time doing that, that's laudable and great. That's a choice they need to make. But it is an expensive choice for the family budget because they're giving up that income, which puts a roof over their head. Or if they want to go work in the labor market, that's an option too, but it's also expensive because then they have to pay for childcare. And so I've established that they have less private income when their kids are young than when their kids are old. Instead of counteracting this, public policy sort of makes it worse. Public policy invests more in families and kids when the kids are older than when the kids are younger. So we did a deep dive to try to get our hands around all the different kinds of public expenditures on kids and families as a function of the child's age. So we looked at Medicaid, we looked at food stamps, we looked at child care, we looked at earned income tax credit, we looked at child tax credits. We tried to get everything we could, and we tried to get it as a function of children's age. And what we found was across federal, state, and local, as best we could figure, this is how much we are investing in families as a function of children's age. And the big difference here is that once kids hit kindergarten age, we start investing a lot. We invest like $10,000 a year per kid in K-12, and before that we don't. And so at precisely the time when families have the least private resources, families are also getting the least public investment. And we think about a college, affordability crisis, but we have a lot of policies to support investment at that time. We have a lot of policies to support investment in K-12. We have much less robust investment in families with young children, precisely the time when kids' brains are, really setting the course for the decades ahead. This shows up. We looked at child time use. This just says the same thing in a more complex way, focusing on time. The key thing here is that the yellow bars, so on the vertical there, you can see kids' age in years. So look at sort of age 5 is kind of in the middle, age 6. There's that big yellow bar there. That's telling us that about half of kids' time during the standard work hours, during the standard work week, are spent in public K-12. The light blue is private K or K-8. So basically the yellow is telling us the public investment in those kids' development and time use, and the other parts are telling us private resources are being used to cover those hours. And you can see that early on, before age 5, 4-3-2-1-0 at the bottom of the graph, public investment is covering about, on average, 5 hours per week of children's time instead of, something closer to 30 hours a week. 25 hours a week. So this lower level of public investment is also creating lower levels of support for and basically putting more private responsibility on the family in a very discontinuous way. I've heard people say, like, you never get a bigger raise than when your kid goes into kindergarten, right? Like, because all of a sudden there's this big space open in your family budget, and this is a reflection of that. So the orange is showing you, like, across federal, state, local investments, it's only, if you look at the share of kids' time, we're only covering a very small share of that. And look, if it were really cheap to produce high-quality care for kids when they were young, maybe this would make sense that, we don't put a lot of private resources and we don't put a lot of public resources towards this time in kids' life. But in fact, it's expensive to provide care for kids, because you can't split the cost of the adult very finely. When kids are in kindergarten, you can split it 20, 25, 30 ways. When kids are infants or toddlers, you know, you can split it 3, 4 ways. You know, that's a lot of work. That's a hard job. There's no way to produce this cheaply and well, right? If you have a parent do it, that's great, but that's a whole adult full time, or, you know, maybe watching their own set of kids, but it's still, you can't divide it very finely. The economics are such that producing care for young kids is a very labor intensive enterprise, much more labor intensive than K-12, whether it's the parent or someone else doing it. So look, families have the least private income when their kids are young, and the public puts the least support towards when kids are young. Parents have the highest care responsibilities when their kids are young. What else could we possibly expect to happen besides shortages? There's not enough money to induce people to provide care, for businesses and enterprise to open to serve this market. You hear about this from constituents, I'm sure. It's really hard for them to find available slots. If there are slots, the prices are very high, or they have to go a long way to find them. You also hear about it showing up in terms of workforce stability, people quitting the business, too much staff turnover. But basically what it means is, like, there's not enough resources going towards this enterprise to make it a sustainable, you know, flourishing business. And why? Because we don't have any private resources and we don't have much public resources going towards it. And what else could we expect? These 5 years when kids are young, each kid is young, and more years than that if you have more kids, it's really hard for parents to meet that dual burden of dual responsibility of care and earning. That's the crisis we face. Shows up in terms of housing instability and just general crunch in families' budgets. That's the second piece of my talk. I'll pause if you guys are being so polite. I don't know. You can feel welcome to push back or
looks like you can
in.
Keep going, and then there All may right. be questions at the end. And keep,
sure. Feel free to so the last bit I want to mention is trends in Minnesota. So I've been working with Liz Davis and a couple of PhD students. We've been and using data from DHS to look at trends in child care in Minnesota in the private market and public provision. And, you know, I know the Center for Rural Policy and Development did a report on this last couple years they did. We see similar things. So we see the blue, so on the left you have Greater Minnesota trends, on the right you have the metro trends. What you see is that in both regions, family child care is going down, the blue lines are going down. You see center care is going up, the red lines are going up. What we added here is we also tried to measure public slots, so by tracking how many schools and Head Starts are providing care as best we could. You can see that there is expansion in public slots in both regions as well. I know there's been a lot of attention to this decline in the family care capacity, and it, you know, especially for outside densely populated areas, family child care has to be part of the solution, just because there's you can't get enough scale to operate a big center. So this is a concern. I just wanted to point out this report that came out over the summer that looked at Minnesota, Wisconsin, and North Dakota. Minnesota is the dotted green, and Wisconsin is the blue. You know, these are two different states with two different set of political institutions and regulatory institutions and funding institutions. two different, very similar economies, though. And what you see is that the trends in this decline are just rock parallel. So this is not just a Minnesota phenomenon. This is a phenomenon that many states are experiencing. And to me, I look at the labor market as a big piece of this puzzle. You know, the labor market's been steadily improving over this period, and so there's sort of more opportunities to entice people out of this sector. That's a theory, and it explains this fact. But we're working to try to test that more robustly and look at the drivers of this trends. We've been trying to build better measures of family access to early care and education services, and trying to get a handle on, you know, supply, quantity, cost, and quality, building measures that reflect all of those and do it in a localized way. I won't spend a lot of time on this, but I just wanted to tell you that we're working on it. We've developed these community access reports that give information at the county level. We've also done them at the state house and state senate and school district level. You can find them online. They also give like maps of each community, and you can see areas with high and low quantity and prices. And it takes also into account travel times, the cost of that. And I'm happy to speak with anyone after who's interested in those. The last thing I just want to say for you all, I mean, you all have a big responsibility, and to govern this piece of our policy. And I think my understanding of sort of the policy debate in Minnesota, we've been locked into this, you know, debate about scholarships and all-day K, and, you know, it's been very program-focused. But I want to encourage you to, like, think about this not in terms of particular programs, but to think about, like, program parameters. So the way, when we think about the dimensions of early childhood investment policy, one dimension is what age range are we going to focus on? And, you know, different programs have different focuses, but we should start from, you know, that question. What age range do we want to invest in? And then another dimension is like family income or differences between families in terms of resources. And, you know, targeting things on income can have bad effects in terms of incentives on some level, potentially in theory, although there's not a lot of evidence that that's big in practice. But, you know, do we want to target lower income? Do we want to have a kind of sliding scale that is not so abrupt, a change from, you know, subsidy, no subsidy, but something that is more smooth adjusting and a sliding scale and has benefits across the spectrum. You know, what prices do we want families to face? So there's a difference between the cost of production and the prices that families pay. And if there are benefits to the community of having kids have better early experiences, and if there are market failures that lead families to, like, credit constraints that lead families not to be able to make these high-impact investments, and there are, I think, a lot of evidence for that, then there, you know, we might think it makes sense for there to be a difference between the cost of producing this and the price that families face, and the public might join the family in investing. And that's, from an economics perspective, why we do that. And so thinking about how to use prices to encourage good investments.
Professor, so Jordan, I want to move you to wrap up pretty soon, because I want to get a chance to move to questions. Okay. Well, yeah, maybe I'll have you do that, and then I'll have a couple, I'm sure that other folks will as well. I just want to keep an eye on time.
Thank you. Let me just say one last thing about this. So to me, the big question is quality assurance. Like, how are we going to make sure that we're getting the quality and care experiences that we want? You guys have tastes. You know, we have a portfolio of tools, regulations, parent choice, informed parent choice through supports, information tools like Parent Aware. Head Start uses performance standards with private contractors or producing in schools. But all of those are just a way to ensure that there's accountability and quality. All right, so wrapping up, early experiences have lifelong consequences. We should think about this time in kids' life as a, you know, once-in-a-lifetime investment opportunity, not as a burden that needs to be covered. It's both, but, you know, we don't get those years back. We ask the most of families when they have the least, and it provokes this set of crises that are entirely predictable. And if we have better information, we can make better decisions about where to invest resources. So that's me. That's my email. I work at the university. I'm always accessible to policymakers, part of my job. So.
Questions, thank members? Thank you, Professor. Representative Franson.
Thank you. Thank you for your time here this morning. Very interesting. The I found the slides on the trends very interesting. You know, we saw this decline starting happening about the 2010-2011, which correlates to when, and this has nothing to do with you, so I'll just walk members who weren't here back through a little bit of history, okay? So there was a movement when Governor Tim Pawlenty was in office to unionize the child care providers. And Governor Tim Pawlenty was not supportive of that agenda. And it kind of fell to the wayside until the election of Governor Mark Dayton. At around 2011-2012, the topic came up again with the unionizing. And that then passed. Governor Mark Dayton tried to do it with an executive order. Okay, it went through the courts, and it was found not constitutional, and the governor was told to go through the legislature. And that's what happened in the election of 2012. So it went through the legislature. It passed, which providers themselves, the private providers, did not. It only affected the home providers, not center-based. And they did not want to. They pled. They rallied, and their concerns were not heard. That frustrated a lot of providers, and they started exiting the marketplace at that time. In the next year or so, there was a vote. It failed. So it fell through. It didn't happen. They were able to somewhat do a sigh of relief, but then the regulations started coming in from DHS. A lack of the department's communication with licensors across the county. They were interpreting rules and statutes however they felt so, and really started coming down hard on the child providers, the private providers. Regulations such as if a licensor thought that their grass was too pokey, they were getting written up for that. We've got citations of bird poop being on a sidewalk, and since there was bird poop, that's an unclean environment, and providers getting written up for things such as that nature. And then the most ridiculous thing this summer, which affected the centers, water bottles. If a center wants to use a water bottle, they now have to take some sort of special training on the safety of water bottles so that their kids in the center can use those water bottles. I mean, absolutely just ridiculous things. So now that the providers themselves are very organized, they're paying attention to this, but they're also seeing the rise of the public education centers, which is competing with the private centers, driving more private centers out, and private industry cannot compete when government is swallowing up their businesses. So something to think about. I'm off my soapbox, and I yield my rest of the time here.
Thank you, Representative Franson. Professor Sojourner, anything you want to say in comment to that?
So I don't have a deep analysis of, you know, the impacts of these regulations. I'll just note that Wisconsin had a Republican governor, Republican legislature. I don't know that they had similar changes, and I don't know that they had a unionization effort, and they experienced similar declines. So I think if we want to understand this decline, that could be part of the story, but I think the fact that the same decline is happening next door suggests that there's also, you know, other factors at play. That's not the only thing driving this trend.
I wanted to just ask Professor about, towards the beginning of your presentation, you linked family income a lot with results. I actually see a slide that was sort of at the back of your presentation. You didn't discuss, but talking about the word gap in terms of number of words that kids hear, just a lot of these gaps and differences that are based on family income. I think we think of the United States in particular as being uniquely a country of mobility where your family income shouldn't matter. You can have a child that grows up in poverty and grow up to be rich, et cetera. Can you help us to square that sense that we have about our country and how things work with some of the data you've pointed out about family income having a huge effect on even the amount of brain matter that a kid has at 18 months or 2 years?
Yeah. So social mobility has declined in the U.S. This is, I think, an avenue for creating more equality of opportunity, which is, I think, in many areas of public policy, there's kind of a brute trade-off that we face between promoting efficiency, promoting, you know, higher productivity versus promoting more equality. And, we can come down in different places about how to make that trade-off. But I think in this area, it's one of the very few areas where that trade-off is really not present, or at least it's much weaker, that we can help future Minnesotans have higher capacity. We can help present Minnesotans, find opportunities in the labor market or find opportunities to parent better at home by supporting them in creating a great experience for their kid growing up and parenting. And, the dollars make the biggest difference in places where the kids are getting the least dollars, right? Kids who are from high-income families, adding a few more dollars to that family's budget in terms of either, it's not going to make a big change in that kid's development. It's not going to make a big change in that kid's experience. But there are many kids in the community where they're really struggling, the family's struggling, and and this is true in communities all over the state. This is not centered in one part of the state. This is true. If you look at our community access reports, you can see there's within every community there's variation, if we invest in those kids, we get these returns. They pay off and down the road in terms of more productive workforce, less problems running into the criminal justice system. They make better neighbors, make better citizens, make better workers, better entrepreneurs. And that's really the foundation of Minnesota's success, I think, in the global economy, is its people. That, if you want to produce low-wage goods, Minnesota's not the place for you, probably. But if you want to have innovative, cutting-edge, differentiated products, you need highly educated, productive, inventive workforce. That's our future. We're not going to outcompete on the low end. We're going to outcompete on the high end. And I think this is a happy policy space where we don't face this sharp trade-off between efficiency and equity, and we can get both. There's money laying on the table for us to take. You offer me 8% rate of return, like, I'll take a lot of that investment. I'll buy that all day long. I'll ask you for more. Like, how much are you willing to sell me? That's a good rate of return. That beats the stock market.
I think Representative Wasilewicz has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit. We looked at kind of family income in here. Did you take a look at intergenerational poverty at all? So is this trends that we're seeing that were started in previous generations that are continuing, or can you speak a little bit to that?
Professor Sojourner.
Yeah, I think that is a real issue, that because families don't have resources when their kids are young, the kids don't get a great start, and they don't have the same opportunities other kids do. And so, you know, it ends up, you see the effects later in life for them and for their kids. There has been some work looking at the intergenerational effects of these kinds of investments. For instance, Head Start, you know, early on, when now it's happened long enough ago that we can see the second generation. And people have been studying this and seeing positive effects in terms of the children of the kids who were had access to the early Head Start programs. Now their kids are taking tests and growing up, and they're not having differential access to Head Start themselves, but because their parents did, you can see that their kids are doing better. So it is a virtuous cycle, I think. And I do want to be cautious. Like, you know, I don't mean to overpromise here. Like, I think there's wildly high estimates from these demonstration projects, and then there's sort of more modest estimates from other studies and other settings. And it is a challenge to scale up from these little demonstration projects to like real policy scale. And it's not a trivial matter to just say, like, we can get that thing that they got 40 years ago here today at scale. But this is an area where there's better evidence than almost any other area that there's brain science. There's like a whole convergence of evidence from a lot of different lines of inquiry, and they all point to this as an opportunity.
And building on that, Professor, I guess what I take from what you've described and the other presentations we've seen, we can discuss different interventions and different rates of return of various things, but I guess the analysis you've put forward, it seems to me, is just pointing towards the need for investment in this area in general. Just when you do that economic analysis, that it's the biggest payoff, we have the least investment in public money, and families are in the worst position in their lives to make a private investment. There's just a massive gap there.
Exactly.
However, whatever kind of detail, am I getting that right?
Exactly right. I feel like we, for a long time, debated whether we need to invest here, and I feel like we've moved past that debate, as we should, because the evidence has piled up, and now there's a lot of discussion about how to do it, and there are trade-offs there, and like, but I think that's. Yeah, I agree with your characterization.
And I might disagree with you a little bit, Professor, just in that in setting our, you know, nearly $50 billion budget, I'm not so sure that the question of whether to make a very significant investment in early childhood is in fact settled.
Well, I defer to your expertise on that. I'm sure you're right about that.
Anything further, members, before we let the professor go? Good. Well, thank you very much, Professor Sojourner. We appreciate your presentation. We do have a quorum, which we didn't have at the very beginning, and so if I can have a motion to approve the minutes of our last meeting.
So moved.
Representative Bonner approves or makes a motion to approve the minutes. Any additions or corrections to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? And the minutes are approved. And we're bringing up our second presentation. So we've heard about some of the dynamics in this in child care, early care and learning. And now we're going to hear about how those dynamics are working out in Minnesota with some really innovative data that's been gathered over a series of years now by the Children's Defense Fund through their Kids Count program. And so I will ask our testifiers once they get settled to introduce themselves and then to feel free to begin. Just remember to speak right into the mic so that we can record what you're saying. So yeah, feel free to begin. Introduce yourself if you can spell your first and last name, or maybe your. I guess we've got you on the agenda, don't we? Okay.
Thank you, Chair. Jennifer Bertram with Children's Defense Fund, Minnesota.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Stephanie Hoganson. I'm the Outreach Director at Children's Defense Fund, Minnesota.
And feel free to begin.
Thank you. We're here today to talk about the Kids Count data book, and I think each of you has a copy of that. Plus a copy of the PowerPoint slides. Yes, okay. This presentation does kind of walk us through the data book, so you can turn the pages as we go and see more closely the graphics and charts that I will describe as we go along in this presentation. Thank you.
You mean hit escape or something?
Clicker.
There we go.
Sorry.
Okay.
Technology is always the thing that makes me most nervous.
No problem.
Okay. Children's Defense Fund is a national organization that is nonpartisan, nonprofit, and we are one of 8 state and regional offices of this national organization, headed up by Mrs. Marion Wright Edelman, who founded our organization about 45 years ago and just recently stepped down into a new role of President Emerita. So we are currently in the process of searching for a new leader at our national office. The local office, Children's Defense Fund Minnesota, operates with a number of programs, including the legislative advocacy work that we focus predominantly on early childhood education, child care, health care, and economic stability, but also with overall child well-being in mind. Our research and education focuses specifically mostly on our National Kids Count project that I'll go into a little more detail about soon. And we have outreach and organizing featuring our Bridge to Benefits online tool that is a way for people to determine eligibility for a number of services and supports that can provide help to families. Our Voices and Choices Coalition is a group of individuals that are advocating for children birthed through age 8 predominantly on issues of importance to American Indian and children of color, and particularly around their health care and educational needs. And then our youth leadership team operates and oversees a number of Freedom School programs in the metro area that provide some additional educational support to children through after-school and summer programs. And our Beat the Odds scholarship awards 5 different individuals a scholarship for college who have overcome great challenges and are planning to attend school. Okay, now this is working better. The National Kids Count Project is a group from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, and they have operated this program for a number of years, over almost 30 years, and the Children's Defense Fund Minnesota has been the grantee for Minnesota for nearly that long. And every year, the National Project compiles data on a grouping of 16 indicators in these 4 components of child well-being: family and community, education, economic well-being, and health. And Minnesota overall consistently ranks up there at the top. This year we were ranked 4th among our peers across the country. But when you look at the subcategories, most notably, we dropped in each one of those 4 components, including going from 1st to 6th in health and 8th to 11th in education. So we're keeping an eye on those indicators as we move into 2019 and determine what we need to do to shore up some of those areas. And when we look at our disaggregated data, when we look at it by race, we do see that we have a lot of disparities in our outcomes, and I think that's what's kind of driving some of these drops in some of these subcategories, and I'll talk about that a little bit more as we go along.
Ms. Bertram, we've got a question from Representative Cortizo-Witun.
Yes.
Thank you. I'm just hopeful to clarify, was that drop, the drops that you just spoke about, was that in from 2017 to 2018, or has that been incremental?
Ms. Bertram.
In 1 year, okay. We dropped, yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please continue. Thank
you. Okay, and I just wanted to make note of a tool that's available to everyone, the Kids Count Data Center. You can go online to this website and access a number of data, a lot of data from a number of different indicator categories for Minnesota and national. And you can look it up by congressional district and by county and school district and statewide. And we at CDF Minnesota update a lot of the statewide and county level indicators on this website, and then our National Kids Count Project also updates some of the census data and some other information as well. So it's a great resource for anyone that wants to look at a lot of data around for children in a number of key areas to design some graphics and charts and maps and things like that if you want to look at trends over time. One thing that Kids Count is looking at pretty closely is we're coming up to our census 2020 next year, and historically we have a number of individuals that that we are concerned about that tend to be undercounted in the census, including children under age 5. They're one of the at-risk categories, along with low-income people, people who are living below poverty level, and all of these other areas that are listed here. And just to make note of the importance of this, the Kids Count Project relies really heavily on the census data to look at our indicators and trends. A lot of the data that we include in our Kids Count Project and on our data center website is census data. So we recognize the importance of ensuring that that data is as accurate as possible and that all of those undercounted communities are represented, especially because a lot of federal dollars are allocated on the basis of the outcome of the census information, as well as state and local. And we also are right at the border of determining whether or not we will keep our 8th congressional district. So it is really important to do some outreach and education around the importance of responding to the census. So there are some efforts being done for outreach and education right now in Minnesota to ensure that people understand the importance of responding to the census. And as I mentioned, it's important to examine our data by race and ethnicity because we have a lot of those disparities in our outcome data for children of color and American Indian children. A lot of our data is available based on these kind of main racial categories that the Census Bureau uses, but we also recognize the need to look at data even more finely disaggregated into subsets of these racial categories. And we know with children of color and for immigrant children, they have different needs and different challenges and different strengths than children whose families were born here and things like that. So as much as we can disaggregate that data and better understand some of those subsets racial categories, it's more helpful for us to really hone in on the needs of individuals and families. And at CDF, we recognize the historical trends in policy creation that Minnesota has historically continues to be a white majority state, but we are growing in numbers of people of color. So we're recognizing that structural racism has been is found in a lot of the policies and programs that children benefit from, and that does affect outcomes for children of color and American Indian children. So again, just better understanding how these policies affect children of color will help us better address some of those outcome disparities. So here's a breakdown of the percentage of children by race and ethnicity. We remain 70% non-Hispanic white. It's important to note that children under age 18 are almost a quarter of the Minnesota population, 1.3 million. And young children under age 5 are 27% of all the Minnesota children. So that's about 70,000 children per single age group under age 5. The data book this year, we organized it to mirror our national child well-being indicator categories for so safe and supportive homes and communities, economic well-being, health coverage and care, and then high-quality early childhood and K through 12 education. We know that children who are safe in their homes and their communities have better overall outcomes, so it's really important to ensure that that safety is of a high level importance for families. One thing that we recognize that is a really great example of the impact of structural racism and inequities for housing decision making, both informally and formally, historically in our state, you see here that only 1% of non-Hispanic white children live in an area of concentrated poverty, and that's defined as a census tract where 30% or more of the people living in that area are living in poverty, versus almost a quarter of American Indian and African American children. And you know, that's significant because even if you aren't living in poverty, but you live in one of those areas of concentrated poverty, you lack access to a lot of resources and services and supports that people in more affluent areas are, instead, including full-service grocery stores and all kinds of things that make life a little easier, and transportation access as well. So one thing that I think really stands out in terms of disparities is looking at the numbers of children in out-of-home placement or foster care. You'll see here that American Indian children have a very high rate of out-of-home care compared to all other races, and 131 per thousand in 2017. And I know that the Legislative Task Force on Child Protection has continued to look at some of those disparities for American Indian children and African American children to determine how to address some of those challenges facing the child protection system in Minnesota. And we do know that the numbers have been increasing over the last few years since the high-profile Eric Dean case triggered the governor's task force on child protection. Moving on to economic well-being, we know that children whose families can even have about an extra $1,000 per year, that goes a long way towards ensuring that people can pay for their basic needs and live a little more comfortably and be economically stable. Yet, you see again the disparities in children living in poverty by race and ethnicity, where overall 13% of children in Minnesota, so more than 1 in 10 children in Minnesota, are living in poverty, which in 2018, the federal poverty guidelines were set at $25,100 for a family of four with two adults and two children. So those disparities persist, where you see 36% of American Indian children living under that threshold, along with about 38% of African American children. And as the previous speaker noted, a lot of families with children under age 5 experience that the most. So 14% of children under age 5 live in poverty in Minnesota overall.
Ms. Bertram, how does that compare with Minnesotans overall or adults in terms of proportion living in poverty, if you know, or Ms. Hoganson?
Well, nationally and in Minnesota, children live in poverty at much higher rates, and I believe about 10 or 11% of the adult population lives in poverty in Minnesota. So, of course, children are more likely to live in poverty, as well as I also think it's important to look at the low-income number because, of course, $25,000 for a family of 4 a year is nowhere near basic needs. So poverty is not a measure that should be used to actually meeting needs for children and families necessarily, though it's a time-tested trend available measure.
So I guess just to clarify, though, so children, especially young children, are living in poverty at significantly higher rates or living in low-income families at significantly higher rates than Minnesotans as a whole. Kind of the younger a Minnesotan is, the more likely they are to be living in poverty or low-income situation.
Correct. And right? I think for some of the reasons Professor Sojourner outlined.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. So we see that the state minimum wage just went up in Minnesota to $9.86 per hour for large employers, and Minneapolis and St. Paul both have committed to moving towards a $15 per hour minimum wage over the next several years. But interestingly, the Department of Employment and Economic Development estimated that a statewide living wage for two earners with two children is around $21.23 per hour, which translates to about $88,000 per year for a family of 4, which, you know, their estimation of a living wage is that, you know, you can make ends meet, pay for your basic needs without needing any kind of support, such as SNAP or Medicaid. So we know that even those making $11, $12 an hour doesn't exactly pay for all of the needs of families raising children. So those work support programs really do go a long way towards supplementing the needs for people to pay for those basic needs. And then moving on to health coverage and care, we know the economic importance of ensuring that people have access to affordable health care and are able to access prevention so that they can prevent more costly care later on. So our whole community benefits from making sure that people have access to that health care and in an affordable way. And that's something that Minnesota has really committed to for a number of years. This chart reflects the significance of the impact of the Affordable Care Act of 2013, where Minnesota expanded eligibility for medical assistance. So the number of children who were covered by MinnesotaCare dropped, while the number of children who were covered by medical assistance increased, where more people became eligible. And interestingly, MA provides health coverage for 38% of all children and 43% of all babies born in Minnesota. So it's a pretty significant proportion of children who benefit from medical assistance here in Minnesota.
Ms. Bertram, we have a question from Representative Cotizzo-Batun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Bertram, I'm wondering, of those percentages, the medical assistance coverage for children and infants born in the state of Minnesota, do we know of that percentage, how many of those children are currently in foster care?
Ms. Bertram or Ms. Hoganson?
I don't know that number offhand. We could get that to you most likely. We could try. However, most children in foster care are going to be categorically eligible for Medicaid or medical assistance.
Okay. Please continue.
Thank you, Chair. So we know that over the last several years, we've seen great strides made in lowering the rates of uninsured, especially for Latino and American Indian children. So you'll see those trend lines greatly improve. But then you can see a little bit of an uptick there for 2016 for Hispanic and a little bit as well for American Indian children. And anecdotally, we're hearing for 2017 as well that those numbers may continue to increase. So what we know is that outreach works in terms of ensuring that people are aware of the benefits that they could receive for health coverage and care, and the importance of ensuring that people do have that access really does go a long way towards a healthier Minnesota. So I'm going to turn it over to Stephanie to take on the rest. You want me to just click for you?
Sure.
Okay.
So last but certainly not least, we're going to talk about some of our specifically early childhood indicators. I just want to note there's a lot of K-12 indicators and even some beyond graduation in the data book, but of course we're going to focus on your purview of the committee. So on the next slide, we show some of the actual data around where childcare deserts exist in Minnesota, which is of course relevant to providing access to early childhood education and care in Minnesota. And Professor Sojourner highlighted why these some of these deserts exist and what could be done. But I just want to note that every region of the state, it's not a rural issue, it's not a metro issue, is experiencing a child care shortage, particularly for infants, which of course have some increased staffing needs as well as other demands that make it and is more expensive, that make it more likely to be a shortage for infants. And then on the next slide, we highlight some of our early childhood longitudinal data system data. Some of you may know a couple years ago, the state launched a system that is a public system, and it's really nationally recognized as a great system of integrated data that allows us to see how children access programs before they enter kindergarten. And I did provide, I believe members did receive an additional report that we created in April of 2017 using the Early Childhood Longitudinal Data System to analyze access to early childhood programs for children of color, American Indian children, and low-income children. So what the ECLDS does is it provides a look back on a cohort of kindergartners and which early childhood programs they accessed. And you can also disaggregate the data by race and ethnicity, special education status, other outcomes, as well as by county, school district, and state level. It doesn't look at all of our 43 early childhood programs that were noted in the OLL report, but it does look at some of those. As you'll see, the four here, the child care assistance program, the early childhood special education program, early childhood family education program, and then district preschool. And in our report, some of the key findings that we found based on this data is that first and foremost, the child care assistance program is the program that reaches the most low-income children and children of color and American Indian children in numbers as well as in rates. So this is a very important program for children and families across our state to not only meet the needs of working parents to cover the hours they need for care to work, but as well as for children to access quality, consistent care across the state. The other finding that we found in that report was that actually Hispanic and Latino children and low-income children are more likely than their white counterparts and higher-income children to access these programs. So if we're trying to make sure that our highest need children access programs, we are making some progress toward doing that, toward that goal. However, underfunding of all of these programs, each of these programs is underfunded with the exception of the early childhood special education program, which receives mostly all federal funding. All of the programs are underfunded, so we're not reaching all of the children who could access and benefit from these programs. And then last but not least in that report, another finding we found was that ECLDS coordinates data across departments, health, human services, and education. And there were a couple case studies and examples of progress in Dakota County and Willmar School Districts highlighted in the report where you can connect services. If a family is accessing, for instance, the Minnesota Family Investment Program or our state's TANF program, providing a resource and referral process to get them into the school district early education program is a great way to connect more families to these services. So you can look at that report and find some of those recommendations. And then last, we'll just end on kind of the program access data around many of the programs that will be, of course, in your purview. Through our Kids Count project, we collect data on a lot of public work support programs and tax credits that lower income, particularly in all Minnesota families, can access. And it's important to understand who's accessing these programs and how they're accessing them so we can eliminate the barriers, because we know these programs work. When families enroll in them, it improves economic stability, child outcomes across a variety of indicators. So what this slide shows is early learning scholarship data, the total early learning scholarship Head Start, early Head Start, and the child care assistance program, the total number served, the percent who were serving children of color or American Indian children is kind of on the pencil at the bottom. And then the most kind of alarming factor is in the pie charts of the percent who are eligible but not able to participate in these programs, particularly due to lack of funding. So all of these programs target lower income families. Head Start and Early Head Start is below poverty. The Early Learning Scholarships and the Child Care Assistance Program is below about 185% of the federal poverty guidelines. But you'll see nearly 80% of mainly 3- and 4-year-olds who are eligible for the Early Learning Scholarships are not able to access it. For Head Start, it's a little bit more than half of children below the poverty line who are eligible are not able to access that time-tested, evidence-based, effective program. And then only 9% of 0- to 3-year-olds can access early Head Start. And then last but not least, we did a comprehensive analysis of census data and participation data to analyze participation in the child care assistance program. And as you may know, there's a long wait list for that program, and severe underfunding results in 84% of income-eligible children not able to access that program. When we look at income and work eligibility, because CCAP is tied to the parents' work hours, we still see that about 70% of young children, 0 to 5, are not able to access that program, though they are eligible due to lack of funding. And of course, child care assistance serves children 0 through 13 or up to 15 with disabilities, but this data is for children under 5, not yet in kindergarten. With that, that's just a quick overview of the breadth of data that we have available, and we're happy to take questions now, as well as throughout the legislative session, provide support on any data around children that we're capable of pulling.
Questions, members? Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you both for your very sobering presentation. I have two questions. One, given that the number of uninsured children has declined by 60% since the Affordable Care Act, is there data about outcomes? I know it's only been 5 years, but are there improved immunization rates or?
Yeah. So there, Medicaid is another time-tested program that has been outcomes, and there's actually been studies since the passage of the Affordable Care Act in 2010 that has showed across the country, this is a trend across the country, that Medicaid access has increased through outreach and increased income guidelines. And we've seen actually connection not just to better access to health and health outcomes for young children, particularly those with chronic illnesses such as asthma that are also very expensive and provide cost savings when you treat them early, but the increase in medical assistance has been tied to increased graduation rates as well as increased college enrollment and success. So there's when you look at child outcomes, when you invest in one area of a child's need, oftentimes you improve other areas of their outcomes.
Ms. Hogenson, can you clarify those prior two slides, your last two slides? I guess I noticed that you're sort of looking at different programs in this slide versus the prior slide. So maybe I guess I have a couple of questions. If you can go one slide prior. First, am I right that these bars potentially overlap, that if a child, receives CCAP and the child's enrolled in a Minnesota district preschool, they might appear in both bars, for example, just to clarify that?
So, yes, I should have mentioned that. So the great thing about the ECLDS, so this is a look back on program participation by program. There is data within the ECLDS that looks at some of that overlap because there is overlapping eligibility. For instance, I believe the OLA report found that nearly a quarter of children accessing the early learning scholarships also access the child care assistance program, and there's a variety of reasons why that's beneficial to a family. But there is overlap, and some of that's necessary to meet families' needs. And so I think one thing the Children's Defense Fund looks at is a multi-delivery system is a way that we need to meet the needs of families and children first, but we need to streamline that access and make it make sense and easier for them to enroll, which is something we've worked on over the years through our Bridge to Benefits project and other work.
And then I noticed that in the next slide, if you can go to that one, that this does not include then, unlike the last slide, district-based preschool, school readiness plus. I mean, sort of, and part of it is there's just a number of programs, right? But so that,
right.
That could be included and probably should be included as well. And we sort of think about the range of programs. I'm thinking maybe ECSE is a little bit different, but just sort of school readiness, et cetera, in terms of the reach. Do you understand what I'm asking?
Yes, and our access report looks at some of that a little bit closer, not these exact data points, because sometimes it's hard to get the right data to be able to compare across programs. But one finding of the access report on district preschool, which incorporates school readiness plus, at the time of the report, it didn't incorporate that, though, based on when those programs were passed, was that low-income children and children of color make up a representative sample in those programs compared to the population 0 to 5, if that makes sense. So if we want to serve, prioritize low-income children and children of color and American Indian children, there is some work that needs to be done to increase the number and rates of those children participating in those programs. However, currently it's reflective of the general population.
Okay. And Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did I hear correctly that there's been an uptick in the number of Latino children who are uninsured?
Yes.
Do you have any speculation about why that is? I'm wondering if the heated national rhetoric around immigration and fear of being involved in the system has played a role. I'm wondering if you have any information to that effect.
Ms. Bertram.
Thank you. I think there is a lot of speculation around that exact thing. I can't confirm that there's data that that can confirm that, but with the groups that we're talking with, we do hear from people who work directly with families that that they're getting a lot of calls with people who'd like to unenroll from programs based on fear of that.
And the
thing.
Georgetown, Mr. Chair,
yeah.
The Georgetown Center for Children and Families released a report in November that looked at the increase nationally. We're seeing an increase in uninsured children for the first time in more than a decade. Minnesota, we've remained stagnant after year-over-year declines. And they highlighted the number one reason they found was lack of awareness based on confusion caused by a lot of the debates around healthcare, lack of outreach dollars invested, and then Jennifer pointed out.
Thank you.
Other questions, members? So I think that we, in that case, are all done and appreciate your presentation and the information that you've provided. And members, we will be on then for next Tuesday, January 29th. What we're going to do is actually dive into some of these programs that are up on the screen and others as well to understand our state spending and understand what's happening with the departments and the agencies. And please be in touch with your ideas and how we proceed forward. So with that, we are adjourned. Thank you.